Is your existing supply chain and logistics consultancy provider failing to deliver? Our experienced, thought-leading team at Loguru could be your choice for an intelligent and friendly professional supply chain. If you have a challenge in supply chain, procurement or logistics, or maybe just want to improve the value you get from them, visit loguru.co.uk. Complete end-to-end satisfaction guaranteed.
Coming up in this episode.
We didn't want it to feel like an auction. So we approached it from the perspective of how do you give feedback during a bidding event without it being you're the top, you're the bottom.
The Logistics Collective podcast is a series focused on the logistics industry where there are many incredible stories to be told. We'll be speaking with those who've worked and are working within the industry today. What have been their experiences, good and bad, since joining, and would they recommend a career in the industry to others? Here's your host, Malcolm Pope.
Welcome to a new Logistics Collective podcast. Remembering and perhaps lamenting the early days of e-sourcing of logistics, we talk about, from our initial spark, how did we move to value creation? And again, I have with me the wonderful Tom Wonsiedler and the cerebral Paul Martin. You and me both, we've both got sort of we're all lacking hair, but there you go.
Partly because of that project.
In our first episode, we really sort of talked about how we actually got together and how we found, and then I was accused of having a shotgun marriage of you two, and you were probably right. And We sort of had an initial sketch out of the problem that we solved, and we talked about both of the solutions and where did they fit. And I would my probable initial observation of both organizations is that you were in a development path to probably compete with one another. You know, there was a, you know, that Tom would take his intelligent RFI solution, which was intended to be a marketplace and was probably looking at optimization as the next stages of it. And Paul probably, there was, I would have seen that your business would have moved away from its optimization and marketplace and would say, well, okay, we need to do something better than a supporting Word document as a specification. You would have moved in the direction. I could sort of see, and maybe I was wrong, but I could see some parallel paths of development, and I was just the unreasonable, I want it all and now.
Yeah, I think you're right. We had overlapping capabilities that Tom and Translogistica were much better at the front-end data collection process, and that to combine that more stronger at the downstream analytics process. But in the middle there, you know, we did some upstream data collection, Tom did an analytics, and so that overlap, your point, made us frenemies in that sense, that we were complementary, but reluctantly, because, you know, we wanted to try to obviously do everything, and we're willing in both cases to invest in areas that you may have thought were weaker than the complement.
Absolutely agree.
That project at that time, I will say that I think the your insistence that we do this together was an absolutely superb decision. It really was.
Yeah, it wasn't without consequence. It was a bit like, let's have a look at the scope initially of what we were trying to do. So I said in the last episode, it's in terms of a contract value, multi-hundred million, tens of thousands of SKUs, multi-site, actually multi-temperature and multi-channel solution. And it was a collaborative tender. That's the bit that that I maybe sometimes forgot. We were doing this on the frozen side with a collaborative partner of Young's Bluecrest at that time. And that had its own interesting handling characteristics as well. How many more parties do you want? And what we wanted to do is look at improving the value that we achieved out of it. So we wanted to take a broader approach. We wanted to look at the risk and cost of change. And we didn't just want an e-auction or reverse auction, but we wanted technology-supported negotiation with humans fully involved and engaged. And actually, it was probably one of the largest UK transport tenders outside of retail in terms of its scale and ambition. And we were using technology in that way for the first time. And I also had a lot of wonderful people in Heinz to sort of get a line to say, well, hang on, guys, what do you want? Because the art of this is about building a specification. And you know, I was probably engaging across five functional areas even before we were building the tender. You know, you were running workshops to understand how. And then you had probably, I think I had a list of unbelievably 30-odd logistic service providers, which were whittled down. But then you had to engage with them. And one of the key things that a lot of procurement people forget is that you have to sell the buy. And so, you know, we had to have briefing sessions and then obviously then training sessions for those logistic service providers to get their interest and then to say, well, okay, how is this going to be? Because it was completely different and completely new to them. What we got from them was, oh, not another bloody e-auction, is it? And, you know, our response to that was, no, it's not. It is something entirely different. And I think some of them got it.
I would say that we ran a full day of training to teach the people who were responding to the tender how to use the system, because it was such a new concept. And they started the day with the belief that this is just another e-auction. We've seen it before. It's just going to beat us up, and it's all going to be about the price at the back of the book. And by the end of it, they were saying, no, this is something very different. I think they did get that it was different. They may not have loved it, but they recognized that they'd not seen anything like it before.
Yeah, so I think, Malcolm, to your point around the internal stakeholder aspect of things, we had a saying that I still use to this day, which is that something starts when the contract's signed. You know, you don't necessarily do that there. And I think, you know, another strong use case for sourcing optimization, this kind of analytics, is it helps you negotiate with internal stakeholders to sort of sell the buy-in, as you said, in that sense, and to do it not based on emotions or intuition or heuristics, but to do it based on facts. And so the ability to go through and run a variety of scenarios and to sit with those stakeholders and incorporate what they're asking of you, and then show them a trade-off cost and ask them and put the onus on them to build a business case to justify that price difference based on the criteria that they're asking you to sort of include. And that's an important dynamic in getting alignment and managing that kind of change versus, you know, just kind of throwing a tantrum or feeling like, man, you're, you know, going back to the drawing board, or we'll try to do that, or just getting into the business without having a sense for that. I remember a case where a plant manager had a strong preference for using a particular supplier, came back to the CPO and said, I want to use this supplier. The CPO sat with them, added that supplier to the allocation that they had recommended it, showed them there was $1 million trade-off cost, and asked them if it was worth it. And the plant manager said, no, absolutely not. And then they were able to sort of find a way to still incorporate that supplier, but only where they had a real strength from a market position point of view, to the tune of about 20% of what they had originally asked. So that's that kind of dynamic, I think, that's really supported by this more nuanced kind of analytics, and something that, you know, Malcolm, you can do in a matter of seconds to run these different scenarios. And that sort of speed on the analytics is something that computers are very good at, and spreadsheets and people are not.
Yeah, and that, I mean, we've got a whole number of things we can talk about, but one of the worry factors for me was the tariff transformation. And so we had to build, we had to synthesize today first. Yeah, so we had to actually build a model within the system that would say, okay, we're going to take 6 months worth of data, and we're going to apply the existing tariff structure, which was complex in its own way because of the some of the flexing mechanisms within there in terms of stem mileage and fuel cost and load fill and all of that. But then to reflect it and say, well, okay, we're now going to test it to say, well, can we get the initial benchmark correct by saying, can we reflect the reality? Because we know what the last 6 months cost us. And that was really the first piece of calibration.
And I do recall that one of the things we had to throw into the analysis was a future unknown risk because of the impending unknown effects of the Working Time Directive.
Yep.
Which added a layer of, who really knows what this is going to do?
Well, I did have an unfair advantage because I was part of the Chartered Institute and Logistics Transport Industry Consultative Committee on Working Time Directive for Mobile Workers. So I did have a bit of an inside line on that. That was sort of the extracurricular hobby that I had. Sorry, go on, Paul.
I was going to say, there's a cautionary tale in there as well, because I think, you know, when you look at the importance of cost savings, maybe, you know, the overemphasis on cost savings, I have seen dozens of companies have put way too much emphasis on establishing a benchmark for which they can measure cost savings. You know, so and so looking at that, I think there's a cautionary tale on spending too much time or too much emphasis on benchmarks, as the purpose of that is to help you measure cost savings. If cost savings, it's important, don't get me wrong, but if you want to look at the value side of things, you do need to be somewhat flexible in the way that you recalibrate how you're going to measure the value on that. And yeah, maybe incorporate that into benchmark. Yeah, but there's, like I said, kind of a cautionary tale on the benchmarking side of things, because it is a tool used for cost savings measurement.
Absolutely agree. And it's not a, for me, it's that and nothing else. It was, that had a purpose. And the purpose of that was all about managing risk. So what you don't want to do is to move to something, and it turns out, even though you sort of look at it on a tariff basis, which it would be hard, it would have been hard to do in that environment. But the, you know, what you saw from a tariff wasn't actually reflected when you actually engaged and implemented it. And so quite often you will find quite theoretical statements of cost saving being made by procurement.
Yep.
And they don't bear out the result of that actually engaging. And I've had circumstances of theoretical savings being declared by, shall we say, one of the big four consultancies in a later role.
Yep.
And seeing that evaporate and just about cover the gain share that they earned as a result of it. And so,
yeah, we call it screen savings.
Yeah, indeed. And the sort of baselining is as much as anything, it is about risk management. It doesn't preclude or exclude looking at more value-based criteria. In fact, it's quite the reverse. But in this environment, it was about validation, because you're going to have some people say to you, you've got to look at those multiple stakeholders, and some of those stakeholders are from finance, and some of those stakeholders are going to be GMs and directors with responsibility for the budget overall. And they, you know, from my mind, I've got to keep them safe. I've got to keep them happy and safe as a result of doing that. You know, that's sort of the minimum. Don't make it worse than it is already.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I worked with a large consumer products company that wanted to change the way that they were measuring marketing. So if you think of the marketing sort of evolution, they used to be measured on impressions and how many people were in circulation for, you know, magazines, and that it moved into, more digital. And so, you know, using source sheet optimization, they went back and used their old model. And then they created a new model for measuring value, and they went through and ran scenarios in which they could choose which model they were going to use to optimize that. And so that they can see the difference there and move, you know, towards a new way of measuring success and value. So I think that's another sort of important point is, yeah, you do want to pay reverence to the past and measure that and establish a baseline and what the impact is going to be. But you may also want to go through and begin to create new formulas for value so that you can then look at a richer allocation. And what's different? If we award based on the old way that we measured sort of value against the new one, how does that allocation differ? And how do we measure those risks? What are the differences in those things? If there's no difference whatsoever, your decision is very easy. If it's dramatically different, then you really got to go through and see, hey,
yep,
are we measuring value in the right way?
This is a baseline level. I don't disagree with anything that you've said. Although, as a marketing skeptic, I'm always going to say, how do you actually measure the value of marketing? But that's for perhaps another session. There is value to marketing. It was a cruel segue of my mind, that, so forgive me.
I use it as an example because it relates to the services aspect of things too.
There's
a lot of things that are not, that are a little bit fuzzy as to how do you look at transit times and things of that nature. How do you quantify what those things are, what the risk aspects? What's your threshold for how you're going to measure those? It's just that services tend to be a little bit more nuanced, and to your point, a little harder to kind of pinpoint as to where the value is.
And I think the next stage in terms of setting up the analytics here was sort of going beyond, once we understood that, okay, we can replicate history in a synthetic model, we've now got to actually build a model that says, okay, this is the new tariff structure that we want. And as soon as you entered into that tariff structure, there were some challenges. So the challenges actually came, Heinz had the good fortune of being largely full truckload, but not exclusively. But you then came to the issue of load plan. And of course, every single different logistics service provider would, given the same problem to solve, would solve it in a slightly different way or a completely different way. And so I think then we had to settle on a fixed view of load plan, so that they could cost really against that. And then we loaded about 6 months worth of data in there. So there was 6 months worth of distribution data, because that actually then drove the optimization models coming out of that, that allowed us to look at the impact of working time directive, that allowed us, and this was live during the event, that allowed us to look at factory gate pricing scenarios, and that also allowed us to, on the fly, build new scenarios. And that was really exceptionally powerful. And then, you know, there was an output from the RFI in terms of scoring and quality scoring coming out of that. And that was then built into the optimization as well as part of that. And I don't see that really these days. Maybe I'm too isolated in my dosage.
The other thing I liked about the way we approached some of the bid gathering was that we didn't want it to feel like an auction. So we approached it from the perspective of, how do you give feedback during a bidding event without it being, you're the top, you're the bottom? It was geared around telling people, are you within range of the market? And by giving them an idea of where they were not competitive and maybe couldn't ever be competitive, it made them think more about, okay, in these areas where I really do want to win this business because I can do it really well, it let them focus on either improving their approach to areas that they were not very competitive on, or ditching those and focusing on where can I do really good business, very high efficiency, and therefore give a better price.
Yeah, I think just to build on what Tom's saying on that, because I really agree that that sort of detail and that feedback allowed the bidders, sales piece, to sharpen their pencils where they needed to and prioritize that. It was a complicated bid package, but it helped them prioritize that sort of activity. The other part to remember is that this was sole sourced, that there was going to be one winner. But that being said, we didn't oversimplify the feedback or the bidding. We gave them feedback on all of the lanes. So it wasn't just, here's your feedback on your overall bid package. It allowed them to go through and say, hey, operationally speaking, what can you do to improve? Because the market is more competitive than you in this, and this area. And so I think that detail, and not oversimplifying that, really did give not just the bidders feedback on winning the bid, but also give them good market intelligence. That's why I think one of the value drivers for the LSPs here was, holy cow, I'm not very competitive in this particular light. What am I doing wrong? How do I improve that? And they can look operationally for where are the areas of continuous improvement. So I think the detail didn't just help them in winning the business, but also help them, I think, be more competitive and make the market, you know, just in being the market better in general. So that was a really big value driver, I think, as well, in the stack bid design.
Absolutely, absolutely agree. And of course, the reason that I liked this approach is that buyers don't tell the full truth in a negotiation, and nor do the logistics service providers. And I don't expect, this isn't a confession in spite of my surname. This is really about saying, okay, can we have some basis of fact? We might not be entirely clear about the fact, and we can change the feedback we can give, but we do change, we do tell people how the feedback is going to change so that they can draw cleverly some conclusions if they so wish. And what I wanted overall is that I really wanted to engage with logistics service providers. We really did give them due credit for the content, the expertise, the quality, the innovation for what they did. I wanted, you know, to do that, and it wasn't a price-only decision. We wanted to buy really a change, a difference, and some more intelligence and more energy and overall a new approach. So you don't do that by turning around and saying, you know, throwing a tariff in front of them and saying, okay, make it lower. You know, that isn't engaging. Was it a perfect process? No, of course it wasn't. There was loads of lessons learned as a result of it. There's a real difficulty with going early. There's always lessons to learn in terms of going early. But nevertheless, it's at the absolute peak of innovation. And I thought that was utterly fascinating. It's one of the proudest things that was achieved, not without some personal cost. I mean, you know, of course, there was zero stress involved with putting this together.
But there wasn't for you.
I would add, too, that, capturing that additional bid attributes, let's say, and not just making it about the tariff price itself, is that you allow the internal operations of a single LSP to compete against itself. That is, they could tell you, I can get it there, you know, in this amount of time, or this amount of time, or this amount of time. That becomes three bids, and there might be different prices in that, but you're letting that sort of internal operations and the flexibility and how they manage the operations to compete, which is especially important in this particular case, because that created more competition for something that was going to be sole sourced. There was one winner here, but that one winner had a lot of variation that they could express in how they could satisfy your business. And I think that richness in those bid packages did create effective competition that generated probably more savings than if you had just gone out there with a tariff only.
True. And again, I was said, you're not going to get 2% out of this. Was the loving challenge? Why are you turning yourself inside out? Was the sort of counsel given to me? And by the way, it was one LSP per temperature regime. So we did actually end up with two, and we had an okay result on one side and a more stellar result on the other. And interestingly, the more mature element, which is about fourth generation outsourcing, was the most radical change out of this. It was the larger part of it, but it was the most radical change. But on that note, I'm going to conclude this episode, and really thanks to Paul and Tom for participating. And we've certainly hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and please look out for our next episode. Remember that you can access all of our logistics podcasts on logisticscollective.com. And please like and follow us, and we'll inform you when the next episodes are being published. We also publish on all of the common podcast platforms, including Spotify.
You can get in contact by email, podcast@logisticscollective.com, or leave a voice message on our website, logisticscollective.com. The podcast is a production by LeGuru.